The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello. We start today with one of the most famous opening passages in all of literature. Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul. Lolita. The tip of the tongue taking a trip of 3 steps down the palate to tap at 3 on the teeth. Lo-li-ta. She was low, plain low, in the morning, standing 4 feet 10 in 1 sock. She was Lola in slacks. She was Dolly at school. She was Dolores on the dotted line. But in my arms, she was always Lolita. Bam. Already, we are in a world of a disturbed narrative mind. Maybe we know from the cover or from our cultural awareness what this book is about. A grown man lusting for a young girl, even if we're coming to it with nothing. The paragraph doesn't hesitate. We suspect this is an adult. And from the clues, the textual clues, Lola in slacks, Dolly at school, 4 feet 10 in 1 sock, this sounds like a girl. The narrator sounds like a man, an adult, a grown-up. He has narrative gifts and reverence toward his subject that seem mature. The author himself, Vladimir Nabokov, is one of the great prose stylists of the 20th century, really all of literature. His expertise in English as well as his other native tongue, Russian, and he has given his narrator, Humbert Humbert, these linguistic gifts as well. We don't expect 12-year-old boys to be able to write prose like this, breaking a word down into syllables and saying that the tip of the tongue takes a trip of 3 steps down the palate to tap at 3 on the teeth. Listen to that sentence. It's like Shakespeare. The sentence itself is doing exactly what the narrator wants it to do. The sound of it is magical. The tip of the tongue taking a trip of 3 steps, tap at 3 on the teeth. This is a world where everything is invested with beauty, where everyone and everything in sight is supercharged with energy, vibrant energy, where details quiver. Where prose itself is as charged as a glorious sunset or a ball of lightning firing across the night sky. Lolita, Lolita with hyphens and Lolita as 3 sentences, every way to say it all there in the first 2 lines. And the first sentence gives us the novel in embryo. Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins. This is a man who loves Lolita, but more than that, he lusts for her too. That's what the fire of his loins tells us. But we also hear that she is the light of his life. And then we hear that she's called Dolly at school, and she's 4 feet 10 in 1 sock and in his arms, where he wants to protect her. There she's Lolita. It's incredibly disturbing. We know this as child abuse. We know it as statutory rape. What do we have it here in the first paragraph? Where is this taking us? We're invited to see it as something else. Sadness, maybe, along with some good qualities. The narrator wants to protect her. He wants to feel love for her. He wants to revere her. And more than that, he wants to love life. We see that in the writing itself. He writes in a way that seems like that makes us feel like we should be doing a better job of living. We should notice more and feel more and expand more. And we as readers have to reckon with this. How do these very human impulses, these positive qualities, the desire to feel love and the desire to protect, what do we do with those qualities when we are dealing with a moral monster? How do they make us feel? Is this manipulation? Are we being pushed somewhere by the artist? And are we responding to this in the right way? If we can even locate for ourselves what that means. What is the right way to read a book like Lolita? The answer is impossible, of course. I'm not going to prescribe a single way to read or think about Lolita. It's a work of art. And that means condemnation as well as praise. It means celebration as well as shunning. It means it fights for its place in our hearts and minds as much as any other work. It's a book that almost wasn't published and yet is, as our guest today puts it, an indelible part of the literary landscape. Indelible. Shocking and indelible. Words as carefully chosen as if Nabokov himself had done the selecting. We'll talk to our guest, Jenny Minton Quigley, about the new book, Lolita in the Afterlife, on beauty, risk, and reckoning with the most indelible and shocking novel of the 20th century, today on The History of Literature. Okay, hello everyone, here we go. I'm Jack Wilson, welcome to the podcast, Lolita. Sometimes the show, well, I like all the shows that we do here and all the topics and all the authors we cover and all the guests. If I didn't, I wouldn't have them on the list of shows we're going to do. There's just too many excellent works of literature out there. But sometimes one comes along and just stands there shining like a gold book, a golden book in the desert, right? Lolita is a book like that. It gleams and shimmers. You might have seen the pictures of the manuscript of Lolita, which was written on note cards. It's the preferred method of a serious prose stylist. Compare this method with Jack Kerouac's, for example, who ran a huge roll of typing paper through his typewriter for On the Road because he didn't want to have to stop to pull the pages out of his typewriter. He didn't want to go sheet by sheet by sheet. He didn't want the feeling that when he reached the bottom of the page, he would stop, an arbitrary stop imposed on him by the format of the pages. He didn't want to have to stop and pull the page out of the typewriter and insert a new one and resume typing. He didn't want built-in breaks. He wanted his story to unfurl and not be blocked out page by page by page. Nabokov went in the opposite direction. Where Kerouac went searching for the universe, Nabokov sought the power of the atom. He went into the story at the sentence level. He wanted to break it down. He wanted to focus on the page, and not just the page, but the sentence, and not just the sentence, but the single word. And when I say he wanted to focus, I mean he wanted his own focus to be on the word. Kerouac didn't want sheet by sheet by sheet. Nabokov wanted more than just a sheet. He wanted card by card, sentence by sentence. Slow down, Vladimir. That's what he was telling himself. Slow down. Focus on the sentence. Perfect it. Perfect the sentence. It's why Nabokov is often thought of as a writer's writer, a favorite of prose stylists like John Updike and Martin Amis. The kinds of writers good enough at their art to recognize mastery. Lolita is mastery. It's a tour de force. And at the same time that it exemplifies art and what prose can do, it calls it into question as well. We have to face tough questions as a society, questions with real-life consequences. We don't give art a free pass because it's good at what it does. When we read, we don't have to sit by passively and accept whatever the author sets before us. We can push back. We can resist. We can ignore, too, if we want. We are free to treat Lolita the book in any way we choose. I am free, and so are you. We can put it on an altar and worship it. We can ignore it altogether, leave it on the shelf. Don't buy it. Buy it. Buy 10 copies and give them to all your friends. Or don't buy it at all. We can criticize it for being inconsistent or hypocritical or immoral or distasteful or for the sneaking suspicion that it glorifies something we don't want glorified. or that it reveals something we'd rather not have revealed, or it titillates or tries to titillate when it should not be doing that. We are not always on the same page as our narrator, Humbert Humbert, and that's fair. But what if we feel that we're not on the same page as the author, Nabokov, either? What if the great novel of the 20th century is not for us? What if it has nothing to say, or nothing to say that we need or want to hear? Now, before you start writing me emails, I'm not saying that that is my view. I'm saying it's a view, a valid one, and so is the opposite. Think of this like religion. Let's say you really wanted to know what a religion was like. You're coming to it cold. You want to know what the religion is like. Maybe you're interested. Maybe you're curious. Is there one book that you would read? One essay? Or would you be better off hearing from a group of people? People at all ends of the spectrum. You might be agnostic yourself about this religion, and you might like to read a book by an agnostic. That sensibility would work for you, and you could learn from it. But wouldn't you also want to know what an atheist thought? And a true believer. You'd want to know what that experience was like too, right? If you truly wanted to know all about a religion, you'd want to hear from people who grew up with that religion and rejected it, who came to it late in life and fell in wholeheartedly, who believe, who don't believe, who have found it to give their life meaning, who have rejected it as superstition, who have studied it historically, who have studied it theologically, who are within a different religious tradition but who admire aspects of this one, and so on. It's hard to imagine one book from one perspective being as good as one book with 30 perspectives. How about a priest? How about a sinner? How about a man? How about a woman? How about someone old? How about someone young? All of these perspectives are valid and crucial. That's what we're going for here with our show today and our book. More the book, really. This is here to... This episode is going to preview this book for you. Lolita is going to give you some of the backstory of the book, some of the goals. We're talking to the editor. Lolita is our sacred object, if we use the analogy of a religion. But even sacred objects deserve close-up examination to see what's good and what's not so good, what's to our taste and what isn't. But there's more to it than just that. We're not just interested in the sacred object being examined. We're interested in the experience of those who have come to examine. How did they approach this thing? And what effect did it produce in them? That's what this book is for. That's who this book is for us. I'm going to take a quick break here and then come back with some more of our introduction to Lolita. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. This book, it's a lot of things. This book is a detective story. It's a chase. It's a romance. It's a road novel. Kerouac is a great comparison in so many ways. Compare and contrast. The papers write themselves. And of course, both books were from the 1950s. On the Road and Lolita, both were the product of the Eisenhower era, the era of interstate highways being built, the post-war world where conformity was king in America, but also resistance to conformity. They were being written at the same time. On the Road was written mostly in 1951 and published in 1957 after going through some revisions. Lolita was started in 1948 and finished in 1953 and was rejected by a bunch of New York publishers before finally being published in France in 1955. 5,000 copies were printed, full of typographical errors, and it sold out almost immediately. And Graham Greene got a hold of a copy and reviewed it in the London newspapers and said it was one of the three best books of 1955. God bless Graham Greene, one of our favorites here at the History of Literature. He himself was having a pretty good decade. The Third Man came out in 1949, which might be my favorite movie of all time. And The End of the Affair came out in 1951, and that might be my favorite novel of all time. Wow. Quite close together. The Quiet American, another Graham Greene great novel, was published in 1955. Which was the same year as his review of Lolita, and Our Man in Havana was published in 1958. So this is a great period for literature, these 1950s. Okay, anyway, Graham Greene loved Lolita. He thought it was important, but when he wrote the review, after he wrote the review, a rival newspaper felt compelled to respond with an attack on the book, with the editor calling it, quote, "the filthiest book I have ever read." Straight out pornography, they said. The book was banned in the UK for the next couple of years, and nobody in America wanted to publish it either. Until one of today's heroes entered the scene, a man at G.P. Putnam's Sons, the publishing house that had been owned by his father. He published the book in August 1958, and it sold 100,000 copies in 3 weeks. That was rare. Gone with the Wind territory for Lolita. The man who made that possible, Walter J. Minton, was proven correct. He could sell this book. The authorities might not have wanted people to read it, but readers thought otherwise. And at least some of them were probably surprised by what they got. Maybe they were expecting straight pornography, something down in the gutter. Lowbrow. Instead, they got high art. This wasn't a film you watch in the back of a store in the flickering darkness. It was nude in the way that Michelangelo's works have nudes, proud and brazen. The obvious work of an artist, and yet transgressive all the same. Shocking. It still is. It's still shocking. It's still taboo. It probably always will be. I hope that it will be, and so should you. The subject matter is abhorrent, and yet, with Lolita, there is always an and yet. So, we were with Walter J. Minton, who died in November of 2019, not long ago. He was 96 years old when he passed away, and every obituary says the same thing. Let me just back up for a moment and say that this is a guy who... Walter J. Minton, who was in publishing for decades, who published The Godfather, who made Friends and Enemies, who lived a kind of larger-than-life existence for a long time, and every obituary says the same thing. The man who published Lolita. The man who brought Lolita to America, the risk taker, the defier of censors, the man who published Lolita. 60 years had gone by since the publication of Lolita, and it was still the sentence that needed no further explanation. No one needed to say, well, there was this book called Lolita. It was famous in its day. It was controversial. No. Lolita is a one-word cultural avatar. A man has died. He was the publisher of Lolita. So, here we are now, a few years later. Lolita is as scandalous as ever, and maybe more so, or at least scandalous in a different way. We do not look kindly on the Humbert Humberts of the world, and thank God for that. There are no boys will be boys here. Not today. Men pay the price for acting as Humbert does in the novel. They go to jail. They're ostracized. There's no winking in our world. We recognize power, and we recognize the abuse of power. We don't call it love when it's a discrepancy like this. We call it pedophilia. We call it rape. We are unflinching in life, and that gives us as much to think about as ever. What does that mean for Lolita? What does that mean for art? So, enter the next generation of Mintons. This is the daughter, who is now the third generation of publishing Mintons. Her grandfather was a publisher, and her father, Walter, was the publisher of Lolita, and now she's here working in publishing, and she takes the torch when it comes to Lolita. Lolita is a fixture by now. Millions of people have read it. It is, as she says, indelible, shocking, but also indelible. It's impossible to imagine 20th century literature without it, but it's also impossible to imagine 21st century literature or literary criticism or just cultural criticism without trying to assess how we're supposed to consider Lolita in today's age. There is no single right answer. There are questions and there are approaches and there are facets to consider. Jenny Minton Quigley has come up with the solution to this. Not a book that sets out a single answer, but one that explores the questions. 30 different writers, Stacey Schiff, Ian Fraser, Erica Sanchez, Roxane Gay, Emily Mortimer, and many others. Sarah Weinman, Laura Lippman, Alexander Chi, Robin Given, Susan Choi, Jim Shepard, Bindu Bansaneth. It starts with an introduction by Jenny herself, who talks about her history with the book, which for her is a family history as well as a publication history as well as a literary history. And then we start hearing the essays on Lolita. We start examining Lolita from all different angles, as if it's a jewel in a museum that we're permitted to circle around, seeing it with all different pairs of eyes in all different lights. So, headed to the museum. Let's take a break and come back with our guide, Jenny Minton Quigley, after this. Okay, joining me now is Jenny Minton Quigley, editor of Lolita in the Afterlife on Beauty, Risk, and Reckoning with the Most Indelible and Shocking Novel of the 20th Century. Jenny Minton Quigley, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Welcome to the History of Literature Podcast.
Yeah, that was great.
Good. Okay.
So, nice to meet you.
So I wanted to start with the book's dedication, which says, dedicated to my marvelous mother, Marion Minton, and in memory of my father, Walter J. Minton, who was to me Robert Duvall in The Great Santini, Pa from Little House on the Prairie, which I loved, Jack Nicholson in Just About Everything, I also love that, and the valiant publisher of Lolita in America. It's a beautiful dedication, and it made me want to know more about your family's history with this book, Lolita. So let's start with your father. Who was he, and how did he become the publisher of Lolita in America?
My father was Walter Minton, and he became the publisher of Lolita. He was the son of Melville Minton, who was a fisherman's son in Red Bank, New Jersey. Mm. He left home at age 15. He took the ferry from Red Bank to New York, and he had big plans for an interview at Standard Oil, which was on Wall Street. But he took the wrong ferry, or he got off at the wrong stop, actually, and he ended up in Midtown, went into Scribner's Books, and landed a job in the stockroom. Mm-hmm. And over the years, you know, 15-year-old boy, no formal education, and over the years worked his way up. And he moved over to Putnam's and ended up being able to acquire Putnam's for a song. It was almost in bankruptcy when George Putnam, the owner at the time, left the company to go find his wife, Amelia Earhart.
Oh, wow.
Who had disappeared. So jeez. My family loves the Amelia Earhart connection. But so my... So my dad, we're probably the only people who are, our fortunes changed when Amelia Earhart disappeared.
Yeah.
My dad, when he graduated from college, went to work for his father at Putnam's. And then very young, my grandfather had a stroke and died. And Walter took over the helm of the publishing company.
Right. And he published Lolita in 1958. And one of the things I was struck by was this seems to be kind of before the rise of literary agents, and your father seems to have had a lot of direct contact with Nabokov. Was this sort of a highlight for him? And it almost seems like it was a big part of his life.
Yes, that's what he loved about publishing. He used to lament the ascendancy of agents, literary agents, because he thought they took all the fun out of publishing.
Mm-hmm.
He loved his relationships with authors, and he, especially in those days, would cultivate, you'd stick with an author for his or her whole career, ups and downs, and
right.
There wasn't quite as much jumping around.
Yeah. Like when you mentioned Scribner's, I immediately thought of Fitzgerald, and it was like he was a Scribner's author.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I went to the New York Public Library twice and read all the correspondence between Nabokov and Walter, and it was just, you know, stacks and stacks and stacks of letters. They must have written each other almost every day. Some were contracts, some were editorial, but never suggestions that Nabokov took.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just, the amount of communication between writers and editors and publishers in those days was, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. So you put the adjective valiant in front of the word publisher for the reference to publishing Lolita. Let's put some context around that for the listeners. Nabokov had completed the book in 1954, but then it kept getting rejected by publishers. So where were we exactly in terms of censorship and the risk of prison and what a book like Lolita meant for a potential publisher?
Right. So it was the Eisenhower era. It was the end of McCarthyism. And the publishers were very nervous. Even a few editors who loved Lolita were very nervous that they would be prosecuted for publishing it. There was a editor at Viking Press who said, "We'll all land in jail."
Mm.
So Walter, that sort of just fueled his desire to publish it, I think. I think he loved fighting censorship. I think he loved taking risks.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about you. And why don't we start with, I want to ask about your decision to enter publishing. But first, I wanted to ask when you first heard about the book and when you first read it.
I first read the book my freshman year at Williams College with Professor Jim Shepard, who actually is a contributor to the book.
Yeah.
He contributed. And I, like many of the contributors who write pieces in the anthology, I remember romanticizing it. I think I aged Lolita up in my mind. I was 18 and I sort of thought she was a teenager too, even though it's clear on my rereading recently that she's 12.
Yeah.
Jim Shepard, he sort of took he diffused the power of Humbert's voice by making it ridiculous. He made him sound like a sort of Count Dracula.
Yeah, right.
And so we would laugh and laugh in class. And I think I sort of thought it was romantic.
Yeah, right. Oh, interesting. which we'll get into all of those different themes that you mentioned. I want to remind listeners, or maybe the ones who haven't yet heard this, we actually had Jim Shepherd on the show, and he chose as two of his books, Lolita was one and Dracula was the other. So the comparison of Humbert Humbert and Dracula, I'm not sure we got into that, but he definitely impressed upon us, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, the humor and how that can serve to undermine Humbert Humbert and some of sort of the unsavory characteristics of him.
Yeah.
At what point did you decide you were going to follow your father's footsteps in publishing? Was that something you always had in mind?
No. I think I'm one of those people who is always just in the moment I'm in. Mm-hmm. And so in college, I don't think I thought for 2 seconds about what I was going to do after. I had read just about every book since I had learned to read. I just devoured books.
Yeah.
And my father, Walter, said to me as I was graduating and thinking my life was over instead of just starting, he said, "Why don't you sign up for the Radcliffe Publishing course?" Which is now the Columbia Publishing course in New York, mm-hmm. but it's a 6-week course where you just learn about all different aspects of books and magazine publishing. And I signed up for that. And then I took my first job, which was at Dell Publishing, working for an editor who published the Outlander series, the Diana Gabaldon book.
Oh, right. Yep.
Romances and mysteries. And I just loved it. I loved it from the second I started.
Yeah. When you were reading Lolita, were your parents aware that you were reading it?
Oh, in college.
Yeah.
You know, I never told anyone. I never told anyone my father published Lolita. I had read Pale Fire in high school. I never told anyone that he had published that too. And then I finally confessed it to Jim Shepherd.
Yeah.
One day after class. And it was like a confession, Jack, you know?
Yeah,
I don't know
right.
why I was so embarrassed about it, but.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. So your parents weren't, I'm interested because it's such a, and that's one of the things that your book made clear to me, or in the introduction made clear to me, is we kind of have this general view that back in the 50s, America was sort of too prudish. The art was overlooked and it was lumped in with sort of an obscenity kind of take on Lolita. And the idea then, I guess, is that today the distaste for it is more about sort of a Me Too objection to it. I'm speaking kind of broad strokes here. But one of the things I was struck by was you pointed out that Catherine White, who I think a lot of people will know as the wife of E.B. White and herself, a strong figure in publishing, she had basically a modern day view of it back then as well, that this was, you know, something people were, they thought about their daughters and they thought about the preteen age of Dolly. And they had concerns about what this book meant and who should be reading it. And all of that was present right at the beginning.
Well, right. That's why she rejected it, I think, for The New Yorker.
Mm.
And because she kept thinking about her daughters and granddaughters, I think even she said. And then the other person who was onto it from the start was Vera Nabokov.
Mm.
And Schiff in her piece illuminates how from the very start, and I read it for myself in her diary in the library, from the very start, she's saying, everyone is missing the point. No one cares about this poor girl, Lolita. Because people were saying, reviewers were saying she was obnoxious, she was hard to take, she was immature, you know, she got beat up as a character.
Right.
Which in a modern lens is almost impossible to read it that way.
Yeah, right, right.
But they were two of the few. And remember, publishing back then in the 50s, most of the editors were men.
Yeah, right.
So it's not that surprising that they were the two who noticed from the start.
When I first read Lolita, I think, it's so hard to talk about this without getting into the issues, but when I first read Lolita, I remember feeling like, I think there's a point where Humbert Humbert says something like, reader, she was not even a virgin, or I was not her first, or something like that. And I remember thinking, oh, well, he's kind of trying to excuse himself with this, isn't he? But it does feel like that's a very manipulative way of trying to turn this into something other than what it is, which is a statutory rape, basically.
Yeah. I just thought of the exact same word as you were talking, manipulative.
At the same time, I think it raises such interesting questions, and it's just a fascinating book. It's a fascinating piece of literary history. It's just, there's no other book that really stands in the same position. And your book really does a wonderful job of exploring this by coming at it from all of these different angles, from all of these amazing writers. And I want to kind of make clear for the listeners that I'm not planning to try to get to one specific answer, either myself or asking you and trying to pin you down on that. But I'd rather just sort of celebrate what the book does, which is all of the questions that people have raised and all of the different approaches from the writers that you were able to assemble here. And they all deal with the complexities of it, and they're all aware of the opposing views, and they try to wrestle with their own feelings about Lolita. Maybe their feelings that they have now, maybe the ones that they first had, and how it changes over time and changes as they grow older and as their awareness, their social awareness has changed. And I just want to kind of make that clear that we're not trying to come down on any particular viewpoint here, but I want to ask you about all of the different questions. So let's start with that. How did you come up with this contributor list?
So, well, even backing up to that, you know, the book never lands on one answer.
Right.
You know, Susan Choi calls it a moral hazard, and Emily Mortimer says it transcends morality.
Yeah.
So I don't think.
Right.
I don't think there's a sort of conclusive answer, you know, even after reading the book.
Yeah.
Which is terrific. I didn't want that. And I certainly didn't want everybody writing the same thing.
Right.
Which gets to your next question, which is, I was worried with a book of, you know, all essays about the same novel. I was worried that they would start to sound too much alike.
Right.
And so from the very start, I tried to think of topics that would be fun to explore.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or interesting or of the moment to explore about Lolita. And then to think of writers who might be right for that. My agent, Jen Marshall, helped me. Stacey Schiff helped me. Stacey Schiff said, oh, we have to have an on-the-road piece. You know, Lolita really is an on-the-road novel. They travel across America. And I think she was even the one who came up with Ian Fraser. So we, you know, I called Ian Fraser, and he wrote the most brilliant piece, you know. And he's a Nabokov aficionado. He wrote about Nabokov in St. Petersburg and, you know, just tracked him every place he'd been on the road. Amazing piece. Lolita fashion. There's a whole subculture of Lolita fashion, this sort of Japanese subculture of these very innocent young looking girls, but clothes.
Yeah.
And then I think Jen Marshall thought, how about Robin Given? And she wrote just this amazing piece about the fashion and also about how she, as a young Black girl, never responded to it. You know, it was like nothing about her.
Right.
So that was really interesting. Then other contributors came up with their own ideas.
Yeah.
Tom Bissell wanted to write about the movies.
Yeah, right. I was going to say that the movies are, you know, you could have, they could be their own separate book almost. I was glad to see that they were discussed here. Laura Lippman was
He did write a book.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay.
He wrote a book. I had to cut it down.
And,
Laura
Lippman was a perfect choice. She's a crime writer we've talked about here. A few times, I think, on the podcast, and she writes kind of about the detective story in the book, which often gets overlooked. That's an element of what's going on here, and she kind of analyzes how successful it is and how that functions within the narrative.
What was so amazing about the Laura Lippman piece is that I asked her, because I love her as a mystery writer, I asked her to write about the mystery of, you know, at the heart of the novel. But what I hadn't known was that she had studied Lolita with Alfred Apple at Northwestern.
Yeah.
And so not only does she blow up sort of this impossible mystery that Nabokov constructed, but she also blows up some of those clues and notes that Apple taught them as fact and have not survived the test of time.
Yeah. And others, André Debus III was reading the book for the first time, which was an interesting take on it. I think a lot of people in the literary world probably encounter it when they're, in their teens or 20s and then maybe return to it. But I thought that was an interesting take that he was reading it for the first time. There's just so many different ones. Emily Mortimer she's got these really interesting intersections with it. And her essay is kind of incredible. It's kind of amazing. She was an actress in The Bookshop, which is the Penelope Fitzgerald novel about a woman who tries to sell Lolita, opens up a bookstore and is selling Lolita. Emily Mortimer was in that film. And she was also the daughter of John Mortimer, who's people might know as the author of Rumpole of the Bailey and himself a London barrister. I thought she had a really interesting angle on the book as well.
Her piece came in kind of late, not late as in past the due date, just late in the sequence of pieces coming in. Mm. It is so brave. It actually is valiant. It reminds me of Walter. You know, there's people in the world who are just brave, and I'm really not one of them, but she is. And she came down and just said, you know, this is a brilliant piece of art. This is a brilliant piece of literature. Nabokov makes us sympathize with a pedophile and a rapist and a monster. And I think her father who defended murderers, John Mortimer, defended murderers, sort of taught her that everyone has some humanity inside them. And I think what a lot of people either aren't feeling or don't want to say, that this is that Nabokov creates sympathy for Humbert, and that this is a masterpiece. You know, she came out and so boldly said,
yeah,
which was awesome.
Yeah.
André Debus, I love that André Debus was reading it for the first time. What I like about how the book turned out is there's some Nabokov aficionados. There are some people who, you know, Lolita has been in a really big part of their writing life and their lives. And then there are other people who are sort of would call themselves, I guess, Nabokov outsiders, you know, who don't, it's not a, they're coming to it either for the first time or certainly aren't experts. And I sort of like that balance.
Yeah, right. I kind of felt like, and I may have talked about this with Jim Shepherd as well, that's one of the things that stands out to me with the book. A lot of people will say, well, the language is so beautiful, it redeems any unsavory aspects of it. And it's not like I want to censor the book or anything like that. But I still sort of feel like, well, that doesn't fully answer the question for me, because it doesn't really capture the experience I had when I was reading it. And the thing that I could compare it with was the show Breaking Bad, which is maybe my favorite television show of all time.
Oh, no one said that.
Walt. Yeah, the feeling and just knowing that Vince Gilligan, you know, he had this idea. He was going to turn this guy from Mr. Chips into Scarface. And he couldn't believe, and he and the writers would just sit in the writer's room baffled because they couldn't believe that the public hadn't turned on Walt. And in fact, he was still a hero. And they were like, what is it going to take? We've already made him, you know, we've made him a murderer. Now we've made him like someone who he's murdering for fun and he's killing a kid and he's, you know, and like everything they could think of that would make him get worse and worse. They thought, well, this is really going to do it. You know, this is going to be the end. People are going to hate Walt now. And instead, he just became more and more of a folk hero. And to me, that was the most fascinating thing about watching the show, is you find yourself rooting for Walt. And then you find yourself asking yourself, why do I want this guy to succeed? He's horrible. He's a monster. He should be the villain. And yet, is it the way that art, you know, is it appealing to something in me, like I want to be free and get away with something? Or is it just the way that art kind of, because he's the protagonist of the show and because you want to root for the guy that the show is about? And that's kind of how I felt like when I was reading Lolita, is why am I not turning on Humbert? And in fact, I even find like I want him to continue to do some of these awful things,
Is it because he's such a fun narrator and his sense of humor is here and because I'm enjoying the prose? And why is this having this effect on me? What is my response really about?
So I guess, first of all, I would say I wish I had asked you to write an essay.
That'll be the second edition.
Exactly. And then the second thing I would say is what you're saying, I think, is what Emily Mortimer would say. It is certainly not what every contributor said. And it's not the way they're teaching it. You know,
yeah.
I sat in on a high school AP English class in my town last year, and the students were so paranoid. They had been taught that Humbert was such an unreliable narrator, that they were being so manipulated on every page, that you got to the scene on the hill where, you know, Humbert has remorse. Finally, he hears the concord of voices coming up the hill, right? The sound of children playing, and he realizes that it's his fault. Lolita's voice isn't amongst them.
Yeah.
And that's the point where I cried, where, you know, and it was like nothing to them.
Yeah.
And I did think, I wonder why they're reading it then. And that's the question that I don't have an answer to, whether they should still be or not.
Right.
I really, some days I think yes, some days I think no, but if we're going to be so, if we're going to be so, paranoid of his character and so unwilling to engage with him, then I don't know if, I mean, I guess you could read it just for the language.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure you need to read it in school.
Right. But exactly. And the thought experiment I had here was, well, what if this was just about a guy who was driving across America and catching butterflies, and it was written with this prose? I do think it would be still kind of an amazing work of art, but I don't think it would be anywhere near Lolita. You know, I don't think it's just the prose that makes it an amazing work of literature. There's more to it than that.
Well, it's probably just that, what you're saying too, right? That amazing ability that Nabokov had, that you do get inside the mind of this person and have of this monster.
Yeah.
And the kid said, you know, the one thing that Walt didn't do in Breaking Bad is rape someone.
Wow.
Because the kid said, you know, we could have sympathized with a murderer. We could have sympathized. The rapist and the rape of a child.
Yeah.
They didn't have Walt do that.
Yeah, that is really the taboo. And Nabokov goes right at it.
Yep.
Do you get the sense that a lot of people take the attitude of, well, I can read it, but I'm worried about other people reading Lolita?
So like who?
Vera
herself worried about young girls reading it.
Yeah.
She thought, she didn't think that kids should read it.
I just was wondering if a lot of people, sometimes I get the sense that people are saying, well, yes, it's art and I can read it and analyze it on that level, but I don't think it should be taught in schools, or I don't think it should be. I think other people are probably misreading it and reading it for the wrong reasons and reading it for the salaciousness, but they're probably not appreciating it the way I do, coming at it from the point of view I do. I just was wondering if you ever had that sense. Sometimes that kind of grates on me a little bit, that some people seem to feel like they can understand it, but the rest of the world is going to not appreciate the complexity in the way that they would.
Absolutely. And one thing I found in my research, Jack, was that every 10 years, there's some piece in the New York Times, or, you know, someone comes along and says that everyone's been misreading Lolita. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of the contributors. I was wondering if anyone was breaking any news here. I know a lot of people were they're such scholars of Nabokov and of this book, and are they, can they expect to hear some little known facts and some, is there any original research that you could point to from any of the authors?
Oh, yes. Let me just think. Tom Bissell, Tom Bissell's piece on the film, you know, maybe everybody knows that the Stanley Kubrick movie for which Nabokov is credited for writing the screenplay, and I actually had to clear permissions with the estate, you know, to run a couple of quotes from the screenplay that Tom included. But the actual movie with Sue Lyon and Peter Sellers does not, the entire movie doesn't have a single line that Nabokov wrote.
Oh, wow.
Not one single one of his lines made it into the movie. And yet he's credited on the screenplay. Things like that.
Right.
And very Vanity Fair style sort of Tom recreates Nabokov working on this movie, you know, going to Hollywood. And it's terrific. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So I didn't know any of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people. I mean, Mary Gateskill had written about Lolita before, mm-hmm. and then she sort of comes at it very differently now.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. Lauren Graff, who I think became a writer because of Nabokov and Lolita, really takes a fresh look at herself and the book.
Yeah. And so, how about A Living Story of Lolita in Iraq?
Oh, yeah. Isn't she amazing? Mm. Dana Sabi.
Yeah. That was amazing. That one gave me chills. Well, a lot of them did, but that one.
but that, just that girl still, it's okay for a 12-year-old to be married off still.
Yeah, right.
And raped.
Yeah.
You know, and right. And it's the daughter whose honor is ruined, not the rapist.
Yeah. I think one of the areas that I am most interested, just from a literary history point of view, is Vera, because she's kind of come down to us as one of the literary saints, you know, one of the exemplar of spousal support, and that she typed his manuscripts and took care of paying all the bills and made sure no one interrupted him and all of that. And she's sort of become this figure of like the woman behind the man kind of thing. And we don't always hear what she thought, that, you know, of the books and of the subject matter and that kind of thing. And I was glad to read the essays that were about her.
Yes, like Stacey
Schiff. Yeah.
You know, yes. She was the wife, right? The and the muse, and but she believed she believed that Lolita was a masterpiece.
Mm. Yeah.
And she believed, you know, that no one else could appreciate, and that they would come to appreciate. But she sort of, even just as much as Nabokov, thought people who didn't appreciate it were idiots. You know, she got it and thought it was brilliant. She, when I did some research and read her diary, Jack, I think she should have been a novelist.
Mm.
You know, she had quite an imagination and quite a love of gossip. She chronicles the whole year of that Lolita is published. Nabokov named her diary Hurricane Lolita.
Yeah.
And it's the story of the whole publication, you know, so I got to read about Walter in there.
Yeah.
And my father had just passed away.
Oh.
And so that was so fun to, you know, see him. He boarded this DC-3 plane in the middle of a storm to fly up to Ithaca, and he negotiated a contract. Olympia Press edition had not only been banned in France, but it was that they had a falling out, Nabokov and Gerodius, and it was all over the copyrights. Nabokov couldn't get it back, and my dad negotiated with both of them separately, and it just is so triumphant, you know. They go to the Harvard Club and launch this book with all the news press, and you could just feel the excitement of both Vera and my father. They were the two sort of business people.
Yeah.
They were the ones who wrote back and forth to each other about the ads. They wrote back and forth to each other about the quotes. You know, they were more of the publishers. I think she loved that too.
Yeah.
And he was writing and catching butterflies.
And was there a little bit for you? My parents were school teachers, And there was a moment I remember when they had sort of a reunion with all of their fellow teachers. And a lot of these people I knew as teachers, you know, and they were in their, I guess, 40s at that point or something. And they showed a film that someone had taken, a home movie, and they were all in their 20s and they were all, you know, flirting and they were playing these kind of risque games. And I just sat there astonished, thinking of this history of, you know, this generation of people who came down to me as the distinguished, you know, graying figures. There must have been some aspect of that when you were reading about Walter and the exploits that he and that generation were having as they were kind of roaming through the New York publishing world. But there was a lot of gossip and affairs. And, you know, it seems like your research must have kept coming across this almost as if these people in your life were like characters in a novel themselves.
Yeah, I wondered why. I did start to wonder why we hadn't met Rosemary Ridgewell, why my dad hadn't taken us to visit Rosemary Ridgewell. And for listeners who might not know, she was the scout who found Lolita. She read the Olympia Press edition, I think, when she was in France, and brought it back to New York. My father was having an affair with her during this time. And she said to him, "You have to read this book." And he read it, stayed up in her living room one night reading it. And the next day said, I need to publish this. But the story, her story, and Sarah Weinman tells it.
Yeah.
Sarah Weinman writes an essay in the book about it, but her story, how she was, you know, paid a very legitimate finder's fee, and then was just destroyed by the press jack. You know, they called her like a nymphette. They called her slithery, blithery Latin girl in Time magazine. And, you know,
well, and she was a Copacabana showgirl.
She was a Copacabana girl, but she was pretty smart.
Yeah, I guess so.
Right? She was also very smart. And
yeah.
I don't know. Sarah just shows us another side of her,
yep.
which I was very, you know, glad to have done.
And that's another perfect pairing of an author and a topic, the Sarah Weinman piece, I thought.
Oh, definitely. She had actually, that's the one piece, and she expanded on it for the book, but all the other pieces, that piece and Bindu Bansanoff's piece are the two that had already been, she had put that up on Lit Hub, and I called her.
Mm-hmm. And Bindu Bansanath,
just expanded on it.
Right. Just before we leave that, Bindu Bansanath is called How Lolita Freed Me From My Own Humbert.
And that one, and Kate Elizabeth Russell on the internet fan club that she was in growing up for Lolita. Those two sort of show a side that I had never considered before, that reading Lolita could be powerful to young girls, just to know that they weren't alone.
Yeah. Right. Do you think that today, is it fair to say we're too heavy-handed in applying our cultural sensitivities to the book? Is Lolita in danger? I know Caitlin Flanagan had said maybe only Lolita is going to survive the Me Too movement. Do you think that there's kind of a feeling that Lolita is somehow at risk of a cultural moment that might seek to erase it?
I would say yes, except that two things. One, every single contributor, pretty much every single contributor I asked to write about Lolita said yes. And that's why it's a 400-plus page book.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to talk about Lolita. So I think that I can't see that moment disappearing anytime soon. It's been a hot button since it came out. And then the second thing I would say to that is that every time I start to think that, and then I open the book, and then it's 2 hours later, and when you're actually reading that book, however you judge it, it's just, I can't imagine it not existing. It is so powerful.
Yeah, right. As long as it delivers an experience that's like no other, it seems like it will have a place in literature.
Right, Right. And but you know what, my father was sort of always like what he just always said again and again. And so I guess what he would want his message to be was that he published Lolita because he knew he could sell that book. And and the literati at the Gates were just not interested in that. That's a, I guess, a commercial mindset, you know, but he was brave enough to take that risk to do it. And they weren't, even the ones who could love it and appreciate every page. And who's to say he didn't? That's just not what he talked about. What he talked about is he was a publisher and he bought the book because he knew he could sell it. And I think what makes me nervous about cancel culture is when it cancels personalities, because he didn't care what people thought about him.
Yeah.
He didn't. He just took, he was a risk taker, right? There's like, my grandfather was the gentleman publisher. You know, there's all different kinds of people, but for a culture, an artistic culture, to really thrive, I think you also need the rebel risk taker. And yeah. And I just worry, that, you know, I just worry a little bit with the cancel culture that we're gonna silence those people, that those people might get knocked out.
Right.
More than Lolita itself. It's I think Lolita's here, but the next book.
Right. Well, if it's as good, hopefully it succeeds as long and as widespread as Lolita has. I want to say,
if someone will publish it, right?
Yeah,
if someone
that's
will
true.
Publish it.
Yeah.
Dan, you know, a lot of people, Dan Franklin and Jonathan Cape, a lot of people, Sonny Mehta at Knopf was very much a risk taker.
Mm-hmm. But people today would, people in your book say, I'm not sure it gets published today.
Right.
Yeah. I want it. This is going to sound like I am trying to flatter the guest. So I guess I'll confess to that at the start. I don't know how to avoid it. But I do think that your book helps to provide some context around Lolita that hopefully will help keep it on people's shelves and on people's nightstands. That your book is a reminder that people can be good readers and be very thoughtful about very difficult and sometimes unpalatable questions. That it's not just that this is literature that everyone, you know, is missing how secretly evil it is, but that this is literature that readers are responding to in a very complex way.
I love that. That's exactly what I hope it does. And that it's a compendium also for hopefully when kids are or students are still reading it in school, that would be terrific, because what I like most about it is that there's no one way to read it, right? There's no one judgment. But there's it certainly gives us a lot to talk about. And talking about books, that's what your show is all about, right? Talking about books is one of the best things we can do, I think.
Yeah, we will keep plugging away. So Jenny Minton Quigley, editor of Lolita in the Afterlife on Beauty, Risk, and Reckoning with the most indelible and shocking novel of the 20th century. Thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Jack. I'm such a fan of the podcast.
Okay, there we go. Lolita. With this new book in hand, go read the novel if it's been a while, and then take a deep breath and read this amazing collection of voices who are going to tell you all about their reading of the novel. You will learn from it, and you will argue with it, and you will admire it, and you will appreciate just what a thoughtful world our little world of literature is when you come right down to it. That's what's great about being in this club, people. And you are in the club, and I am in it too. It's open to everyone who reads great books and thinks about them and cares about them. So we all qualify. That's what's great about this club of ours. We're not the richest or the most famous people in the world, but we're the best. I'm joking, but only half joking. You know, I can't consider myself the best when I'm also convinced I'm the worst. That doesn't work. But when you read these essays, you might find yourself thinking, as I did, what a thoughtful group of people this is. We're doing okay. We are doing okay. And we can approach even the most challenging issues with grace and gratitude and good ideas. We're lucky to have Nabokov, and he is lucky to have us too. My thanks to Jenny Minton Quigley. Speaking of fortunate to have, we were fortunate to have her here today. And of course, to all the contributors to this book, I'm thankful for them as well. I'm thankful for this book. Should have been one of our November shows. Could have fit right in with Thanksgiving. Okay, here we go. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Podglomerate, a sonic universe.